So I'm 52 years old, and for the past 2.5 months, I've been posting daily videos on TikTok as Jeff Perlman author, and I've been loving it. And if you're wondering, why is a 52-year-old author posting videos on TikTok? It's because, why not? Seriously, why not? As you age, you start hearing about all the things you shouldn't do. You're too old for this, you're too old for that. Well, fuck it. Seriously, fuck it. I'm 52. I play basketball every weekend. I listen to Kendrick Lamar and J. Cole and Ari Lennox. And I post on TikTok. I can do whatever the hell I want. And so can you. My name is Jeff Perlman. I'm the New York Times bestselling author of 10 books and the host of Two Writers, Sling and Yang, the podcast where one writer, me, talks writing with another writer every single week. And today's guest is Chris Cillizza, the veteran political journalist and pundit whose career has taken him from Roll Call and the Washington Post and CNN to now, because it's 2024, his political Substack, So What? This is episode number 361. Let's sling some yang.
Dad, your podcast sucks and you smell like Jack Sigmund's armpit.
All right, Chris. First of all, thank you for doing this. I very much appreciate it. You have a very nice setup there. Let me ask you, you have a ton of books behind you. I'm assuming you've read some of them. Of all the books on the shelf behind you, what's your favorite?
Okay, so it's actually one, make sure I'm talking to the microphone. It's actually one that is not on the shelf behind me. I've probably read, somebody asked me this because I use this in my background, always like TV, YouTube. So like, I don't have like an alternate background in my house. This is the one. So people are like, how many of those books have you read? And I'm always like, probably 30%, if I'm being honest, like 30-ish percent. Okay, but my favorite is not, my favorite one I keep close to me. And it's this. What It Takes by Richard Ben Cramer.
His daughter, Ruby, an excellent Washington Post writer.
Great reporter, was at BuzzFeed before and now at the Washington Post. What It Takes is a book about, and this may not, this undersells it. It is a book about the 1988 presidential campaign where you're like, ah, do I really want to read about a campaign that happened, whatever, many years ago? So it is, to my mind, the single best account of why people run for president, what running for president is like. I would recommend it to people because, it, just in case you're not super familiar with politics, someone who ran in 1988 for president was none other than Joe Biden. So Richard Ben Cramer got really close to Joe Biden. And there's a ton of revealing stuff in there about Biden that holds true. I know it was written in 1988, but that holds true and it's interesting. I just think it's like the seminal book about campaigns. And by the way, a book that could, we were talking off air about book publishing industry, a book that could never be written now because the book came out in September of 1991. So it's about the 88 campaign and it comes out in 1991 on the eve of the 92 campaign. So I loved Richard myself, along with a couple other people, a couple of the reporters, Jonathan Martin, who's now at Politico, used to be at the New York Times, Ben Smith, who at the time was at Politico and is now the editor. I don't know what his title is, but he's at Semaphore. We went out to, Richard lived by Washington College, which is in Chestertown, Maryland, beautiful little town on the water in Maryland. We actually went out to his house and hung out with them for a day because he was excited that like these younger reporters were into his book from 1988. Yeah. And we just hung out with him. It was wonderful. And so it has like a special spot in my heart because of him. And he was not in ill health, but he did wind up dying, I think, too young. But I love that book. And I would recommend it to anyone who is even tangentially interested in politics. It's a book I refer to all the time. I think it is sort of some of the best political journalism, just journalism done about politics ever. So that's the one. That's my favorite.
You have worked in political media for a long time now. You now run the Substack, So What? You do these videos every day, all these different things. Do you look back at whatever, the quaintness of Michael Dukakis running against George Bush, the elder George Bush, and think, God, this all fucking sucks right now. And this is not fun.
I look back at the quaintness of Gore Bush in 2000, which was not quaint at the time. right? I even sort of, I find myself reminiscing for Mitt Romney versus Barack Obama in 2012. Like, you know, I don't know how much you can get nostalgic for things that didn't happen all that long ago, but yes, like, look, one of the things, and this was not a, I don't want to say this was a planned transition. CNN laid me off in end of November, 2022. They're making a bunch of budget cuts. I made a bunch of money, you know, like I get it. This is a business. Even though journalism didn't think of itself as a business for a long time, it's a business. So this was not a planned thing, but so they laid me off. And so, you know, I'm sort of like, well, what the hell am I going to do with the rest of my life? You know? And I still really love journalism. I want to stay in it. So I start this political Substack that you mentioned. It's called So What? But I also started, you know, I had dabbled. I grew up wanting to be I wanted to be a reporter, but I wanted to be a sports reporter growing up. And I, you know, just the jobs that I had in college and right after college, I wound up going into politics. But I thought to myself, like, you know, I really love sports. Is there a way I can, number one, so that was, I really love sports. Number two, to your point about the quaintness is, man, it's hard to write about politics now, not just because of Trump, though that's a big piece of it, but just because it's just so awful. I mean, I have less of this now, but I had people every day when I was at CNN being like, put a gun to your head and pull the trigger. You know, I'd like people I had never met, people sending me emails, people threatening me, people coming, we had people come to the house, you know, like. And that stuff wears on you, you know, like I'm 48 now. Like, you know, when I was 22, I'd just be like, man, people are paying attention to me. But when you're 48, you're like, God, like, I've been writing about politics since my first job out of college. So 22. And I really have tried to transition. I wrote a book in 2020, came out in 2023 called Power Players, Sports, Politics, and the American Presidency. That was an attempt to sort of, yes, obviously it's about presidents, but it has nothing really to do with politics other than presidents are politicians. It was really about the sports people liked, the sports these presidents liked, the sports they played, the way they used sports to make political points. And so I use that to kind of transition over. I've known Tony Kornheiser for a long time. He's a DC guy like me. I do his podcast. I started a month ago, I started a sports Substack called The Replay. Like, I'm really trying, to your point. And by the way, I apologies if this comes up. I'm not trying to just like promote all my crap, but I do think it speaks to what I'm trying to do, which is like, yes, I'm always going to have a foot in politics. Yeah, I think you probably can identify with this as it relates to sports and other stuff. Like, you're never going to not have a foot in sports, right? That's where you come from. Like, Starbucks is always going to make coffee, but like, can they also sell you pastry? And my view essentially is like, can I do sports as well? Because politics, at least right now, and I would say for the foreseeable future, certainly through November and probably after that, man, it can be soul crushing. You know, like, I love it. I enjoy writing about it. I like the personalities, I like the history, I like the machinations, I like the strategy, I like all that stuff. And I think it obviously it matters. At the same time, man, it's tough sometimes, you know, like I taught a political journalism class this fall, and, you know, I tried to separate it into, I love journalism. Political journalism is really hard right now. And we haven't even talked about this, but the business side of journalism, you know, it's hard to tell a 22-year-old kid, like, yes, you should definitely dedicate your life to this because the future of it's so uncertain. So, that's why I've tried to kind of move myself a little bit away from only hardcore politics all the time, because it was it's like a personal decision in a lot of ways too, which is just like, what's going to allow me to be like a good dad, a good husband, like a good citizen, as opposed to just like, what's going to make me the most money?
Here's something I've wondered about for a long time, and you're the perfect guy to ask. For me, a guy who does not cover politics, who just watches it and panics, I'm always like, and I went to college with Paul Kane. Paul Kane and I worked at the Delaware newspaper. The great guy.
He and I worked at Roll Call together and at the Post. Love him.
Paul's a pro's pro. And I was thinking, for someone like me, okay, I watch politics and I'm like, oh my God, we're ruined. Everything is horrible. Oh my God, we're falling off a cliff. We're doomed. Democracy is dead, blah, 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 blah. For a guy like yourself, who has covered it up close for so long.
Yeah.
And for people like Paul Kane, like Maggie Haberman, whoever you pick, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Do you guys have that panic? Or are you so close to it that you have an analytical view at it and you think and you realize like a lot of the panic that people like I have is a little irrational? Or is it not?
So, man, that's a complicated question or answer. Well, let me answer it two ways. So first of all, I will say I was definitely in the like people are unnecessarily running around like chickens with their heads cut off in 2016, which is like, yes, like we've never elected someone like Trump before, but like fundamentally what the, you know, the famous question, how bad can it be? You know, after 2020 and the, you know, election denialism and the January 6th and his role in that, and you know, the fact that we came within one Dan Quayle phone call or one Mike Pence phone call to Dan Quayle of all people asking what he should do about overturning the Electoral College. Dan Quayle saved democracy. Like I think I'm more mindful that it's things broadly are more tenuous than we think. That said, I read a great piece in Politico that it was about Hungary, of all places. I'm not a foreign policy guy. I'm not like, what's in the news in Hungary today? I'm not like searching it out. But I was reading this piece in Politico, and it was by a journalist in Hungary. And the point that I think it was a woman, the point that she made was, and they have, if you're not familiar, they have Viktor Orban, who Trump has, you know, many times praised, authoritarian ruler, you know, and her point was, it is unlikely, given the structures in American politics, whether it's the media, whether it's the legislative branch, whether it's the Supreme Court, and we can make arguments about all those things, but the institutions in America are very unlikely to be fundamentally restructured or overturned, even if Donald Trump is elected president. Now, again, what I would say to that is, do I think Donald Trump has, you didn't ask this, but I think you got to talk about Trump in this regard, like, does Donald Trump have admiration for people who are authoritarians and dictators? Yes, there's no debate about that. He said it many times over. Does he have some dictatorial notions? Again, absolutely yes. He said it many times over. I separate out what he wants to do from what I think he can do. I think he can do a little bit less than some of the people who are like, November 5th will be the end of democracy if Donald Trump wins. At the same time, I am mindful that I was whistling past the graveyard a little bit in 2016 in that he said and did more than I would have, as of someone who had spent 25 years in these big mainstream media outlets, than I would have thought possible. So I feel like those answers are contradictory a little bit. I think our institutions remain generally healthy, and I think he will electing someone like Donald Trump will be a fundamental step away from the way in which we have traditionally defined democracy in this country and what a president's role can be in this country, period. Do I think that means the end of democracy? I do not.
Your Substack is fascinating, and you take these micros, which is the right thing to do in journalism, I think. And I actually think a lesson for young journalists is you take the micro, like a lot of people, I always say, when you walk up to Mike Trout's locker, the story isn't that he's hitting 330 with five home runs. The story is the cut on his hand. How do you get that cut on his hand? And then you expand that. And you do that really well. Something was said this, I think it was this week or last week, where the conservative reporter, commentator, you had asked Trump a question about Biden. And Trump went off on this tangent that Joe Biden is probably using cocaine.
Absolutely. Yep. I wrote about it. Yes.
I know. It got so little attention.
Yes.
That the leading Republican candidate for president, the Republican candidate for president, said that the sitting president is probably using cocaine.
Yep.
What are we actually supposed to do with those? Is the New York Times supposed to run headline, Trump says Biden using cocaine, White House denied? What are you supposed to do with this shit?
So I was thinking of that, exactly that, because I wrote about it and I went back to Hugh Hewitt's credit. He publishes the transcripts of his interviews, which is great because you can like go and read it. A lot of these places you have no, you know, unless you see a clip of it on Twitter, you can't tell what he said. I went and read it a couple times and I was like, holy shit. Like, you know, cause he said there was a white powder found in the white, I'm paraphrasing, but there's a white powder found in the White House, and Biden was, he was real energetic, you know, and he clearly is suggesting that. And then I was thinking this morning, so I have an 11-year-old and my kid is super hyped up about the solar eclipse. And Marjorie Taylor Greene from Georgia said something last week after the earthquake in New York. She essentially said, like, an earthquake and an eclipse, God is trying to tell us we need to repent. And like, how do, to your point, how do you cover that, right? Because at some level, particularly as it relates to Marjorie Taylor Greene, right, like, she's just after attention, right? Attention equals fundraising, equals Fox News hits, equals fundraising dollars, equals more social media, equals more influence, right? It's like, it's in her mind, a virtuous cycle. Uh-huh. So the question as a reporter is like, do you, knowing that, right? Like, do you play into it? At the same time, like, she has a following, right? She's not the only person who believes this. It got 9.9 million views on Twitter. Like, people saw it. With Trump, there's this eternal debate, right? Like, conventional wisdom in 2016 was mainstream media outlets for ratings and clicks gave Trump unlimited airtime, and that led to him winning. Then it was like in 2020, because of that, excuse me, we're always fighting the last war, right? So because of that, you can't cover everything he says or does, because that's how we got into this mess in the first place. But now in 2024, it's gone back to, and the Biden people push this, by the way, the Biden people are now like, you have to write about everything he says and does because it's the best indicator of what he will do. So it's really hard to figure out where you land on that. The thing I with Trump, I thought of this in the, with the cocaine thing. So I've used this analogy a bunch because I think it's really appropriate. So on The Simpsons, just stick with me. On The Simpsons, Mr. Burns, if you don't know it, Mr. Burns is the old tycoon in the town, right? He decides that he's going to go to the doctor. He goes to like the Mayo Clinic or whatever and gets a full checkup. And the doctor comes back and Mr. Burns says like, so doc, how am I? And the doctor says like, weirdly, you're incredibly healthy. And he's like, oh, that's, Mr. Burns says, like, oh, that's great. Clean bill of health. And the doctor says, actually, no, you have every disease known to man and a few that we've never discovered before. But what's happening is they're all wedged into the door together and none of them can get out. We call it Three Stooges syndrome. You know, when Three Stooges, the three of them walk into a door frame and they can't get out. I think of that all the time as it relates to Trump, because like, just think, what if Joe Biden said, wow, Donald Trump was really antic in his last campaign appearance. Man, I bet he's on drugs. You know how big a story that would be?
Yep.
I mean, it'd be gigantic.
Yep.
Right? Or Joe Biden. I mean, I still remember in 2015, a month after he became a candidate, Trump is in Arizona and he says, you know, I like my war heroes not captured, right? About McCain. And I remember writing, I was at the Washington Post at the time. I remember writing like, well, Trump had a good 1 month run as a candidate and yet nothing. Now, if Jeb Bush had said that, or Mitt Romney had said that, or literally any other Republican or Democrat had said that, be that, if not the end of their career, they'd have to issue an apology. They'd have to do an event with veterans, right? There's all this stuff they'd have to do. But for him, all of the stuff kind of blocks itself up and it doesn't bust through. Like, I will do searches when I'm writing something. I'll do like a search of Donald Trump and whatever. And I will come, I shit you not, this has happened to me in the last 2 weeks. I will come across something that I wrote for CNN, my byline. And I'm like, man, I don't remember him saying that at all, because there's so much. Yeah. Right. So it's like really hard. It's like, do you make a big deal out of the cocaine thing? Seems like kind of a big deal. At the same time, does that then outshine the fact that he didn't take a position on abortion today? Or, you know what I mean? Like, I don't, or he said that, you know, over the weekend, he said, I want immigrants from quote unquote nice countries like Norway and Switzerland and not from countries like Congo and Libya. Like, how do you pick and choose? How do you decide? Because in a way, if you write about everything, are you flooding the zone to the extent that it's just impossible? Like, to use a sports analogy, if you play defense in such a way in a basketball game that you foul on every play, right? You are forcing the referees to either call every single foul and foul every guy out of the game in the first half, or to adjust the way in which they call the game, because you can, and that's kind of what he does, fouls on every play. And it's just really hard to figure out how you should officiate that.
I thought it was interesting that Trump had a fundraiser recently and he says he raised more than $50 million. And a lot of media outlets reported as fact he raised $50 million. And I was like, I was actually glad to see in your Substack you wrote Trump claimed to have raised more.
Yes.
Yes. It is insane that people, I remember when Trump came out and just when he was elected and he had a woman by his side and he had all these folders stacked and they were
totally, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Divesting of his businesses.
Yep. Yep.
And I had just written this USFL book where I knew Trump was just a fucking fraud all the way. And I kept looking at the screen saying, someone needs to look in those envelopes because they're almost certainly empty or blank.
Empty. Yeah.
The whole idea that we're just still taking what he says as actual.
No, you can't.
You can't.
No, you can't. No. I mean, and that's, look, again, he, according to the Washington Post, he said 30,000 things in 4 years that were either false or misleading. Now, again, people come back at me and say, all politicians lie. True to some extent. I would hedge that. I would amend that to say all politicians exaggerate and clip numbers to their benefit. Most politicians, when called on that, and I would say most politicians, Republican or Democrat, you know, if George W. Bush said something, I mean, remember this, George W. Bush would say something and like the New York Times would do a fact check and then he wouldn't say it anymore, right? Trump doesn't do any of that stuff. So yeah, I think you have to, anything that he says, I think you have to say Trump claims or Trump's campaign says just because of the track record. I mean, if I in my 25 year career of journalism had 25 instances where I had plagiarized, I think it would be reasonable to say, well, you know, is it possible this guy is plagiarizing again, right? Like, it's not a one-off, right? It's not the exception, it is the rule. And I still think he takes advantage of built-in ways that the mainstream media covers this stuff, which is your natural tendency is to be like, so Trump says this, and Trump says he raised $50 million, Biden says he raised $25 million, Trump raised twice as much. And it's like, well, but one of these two candidates has a long history of saying things that isn't true. And yes, like, has Joe Biden said things that aren't true? Absolutely. Are they going to estimate at the tip top of what they think they're going to get? Absolutely. But it's not the same thing. And I think we can't treat it as the same thing.
You worked at CNN from 2017 to 2022. When I was growing up, CNN was like the place. It was the trusted source, cable news, Bernard Shaw. Mm-hmm. If OJ happened or the Challenger shuttle, it was CNN. I've written a decent amount for CNN.com, just guest columns. And I feel increasingly, just being honest, not that comfortable with it, because I look at CNN now and I just feel like it's just really gone cheap in ratings and I don't feel great about the direction of CNN. Now, you may totally disagree with me. I'm actually fascinated. Like,
yeah.
How do you feel having worked there for so long about the direction and place CNN is?
So first of all, I mean, the question I get the most from people is like, man, you must really hate them because they laid you off. And I'm like, no. And in fact, people are like, man, you must really hate Chris Licht, who is the president of, he's not the president anymore, but he was the president of CNN who laid me off. I'm like, dude, like, you know, to quote Bob Dylan, we all got to serve somebody, you know, like he was serving somebody above him who said, hey, man, you got to cut money. Like, I get it. It's fine. I wish it wasn't me, but I get it. I think the really difficult thing, and this is not about CNN in particular, because I've worked at the Washington Post, I've worked at some other big places. Like, I just think what's really hard is it's exactly kind of what we just talked about. So if, okay, here's a good example. So Biden announced on Monday a bunch of student loan stuff. He, you know, some of his student loan forgiveness got thrown out. He announced a bunch of student loans. Like, I'm going to take these actions specifically to try to help relieve the burden of all these student loans people have. Okay, so there's that story. And then there's the Marjorie Taylor Greene story I mentioned, right? Like, eclipses are God's way of showing us we need to repent. Now, let me give you a quick quiz. Which of those two stories is going to perform better from a clicks point of view?
Yeah.
obviously. Right? Like, it's not, I mean, it's 100 out of 100, right? Like, you don't have to be in the news business to know, you know, deeply controversial, I'm trying to be as nice as possible, deeply controversial Georgia Republican says earthquakes and eclipse are the result of God punishing us versus president announces student loan forgiveness. So now, what has more of an impact on lives? Well, the Marjorie Taylor Greene thing doesn't really have any real impact other than, like, you can be outraged by, oh my, I can't believe this person's a member of Congress, or you can agree with it or whatever. The student loan thing, you know, we'll see how much of it he can actually, like, put into practice. But in theory, it has, it certainly has more impact than a tweet Marjorie Taylor Greene sent. So the news business, people don't like to think about it like this, is a business. Like, it was run like a nonprofit for a long time because it was just a money printing machine for, I mean, when I got into journalism, it was great. I worked at the Washington Post. Don Graham owned it. It was a public company. It was kicking ass, doing great. Then Bezos bought it. It was like, holy cow, this is amazing. When they hired me at CNN, they were growing and growing and growing. You were like, man, we're gonna live high on the hog forever. You know, if you followed any media news for the last 3 years, it's all cuts, 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 cuts. So it's a business. They have to figure out how to make money. How do you make money? You get more for TV purposes. You get higher ratings, right? It's not complicated. They have every, for people who don't know this, every 15 minutes, you can break down what the ratings are. The executives get a rating summary every single day. They always look at it. It is essential to how they go about doing their business. If you were, but I would say the same thing, the Washington Post, when I was there, certainly true now, they have a thing called Omniture. Maybe they don't use it anymore, but it measures how many people are reading every article at all times. Where do they come from? Where do they go? How long do they spend on the site? So these, like, business imperatives of eyeballs or clicks or, how, you know, whatever you want to do, that is really hard to marry with the what should we be covering, right? Like, is the job of journalism to give people what they want, or to give people what they need, or to give people something in between that? And as it becomes a worse and worse business, I think all these journalistic enterprises move to giving people what they want, right? So you're going to get a lot of Royals coverage. Where's Kate Middleton? What's going on? You're going to get a lot of, like, crazy congresswoman or congressman says X thing. You're going to get a lot of Donald Trump just said on Truth Social, blah, blah, blah. And I don't think that is a CNN thing. I don't think that is a Washington Post thing. Like, I don't see anybody outside of Substack where it's like, you know, because I obviously follow a bunch of Substacks where it's kind of like, hey, look, this is kind of where I'm coming from. This is what I'm trying to do. I'm not trying to be everything to everybody. You know, like, when the Baltimore Bridge collapsed, I didn't write about it. You know what I mean? Like, whereas the Washington Post, you got to cover that. CNN, you got to cover that. Like, I don't need to cover that. When there's a hurricane, I don't need to cover that. They do. So I just think the business realities make it hard to do good capital J journalism in mainstream media outlets. And I put myself in that category when I worked in those places.
Is it hard, or was it hard? Is there an adjustment to be made mentally when you're a guy, Washington Post, CNN, oh, there he is on TV, blah, 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 all this stuff. You're let go and you start a Substack and you're kind of starting from ground zero to a certain degree.
Hell yeah.
What is that? What was that adjustment like for you? What was it like for you?
So, it's interesting. I think there's obviously no quantitative measure for this. I think I'm a better person today, better husband, better father, better human than I was when I was at CNN. It has nothing to do with CNN. Has everything to do with, if you are on TV and you are going to Target and people are like, hey, you guy from TV, can I get your autograph? Why you would want my autograph anyway is beyond me. But like, it happened.
I was going to ask your autograph after this podcast. No.
Yeah, that'd be awkward. Can you sign 50 baseballs that I have?
Yeah.
There is, whether you are a great person or not, there is an allure to that. It becomes definitional. You think of yourself as a success because people recognize you. So yeah, that was hard. I mean, it was sudden, right? And it was unplanned, right? Like if I could have been like, okay, yeah, I'm going to leave CNN, I'm going to do these other things. But what I realized in that was like, I really like writing. You know, it's like I did it because they paid me, but I like really like it. Like it's a thing. So I wanted to find a way. I watch this stuff. I like to think about it. I like to write about it. I like, it helps me sort of synthesize and analyze my world and what I think about. And so Substack was just kind of there. It's like, it's easy. It doesn't cost a lot of money to say, it costs basically nothing to set up. So I just kind of started doing it a little bit as a lark, to be totally honest, just to, you know, like CNN was still paying me because of my contract. So I was like, I'm just going to try to do this. And that has been rewarding in its own way in that, like when people come, I mean, look, I would write things on CNN, get like a million page views, you know, and you're like, oh, I count a million page. That's amazing. And it is amazing. But it's like, is it a million page views because of Chris Saliza, or is it a million page views because of CNN, or is it 950,000 page views because of CNN and 50,000 page views because of you? I think your natural tendency, all of us, is to be like, it's because of me. I'm so great. You know, like, I think the truth is probably it's the platform more than the person. The thing I like about Substack is, you know, it's me. I have 13,000 subscribers. It's way less people than read my stuff before, but they're there for me. They're there for when I write about personal stuff. I've written a lot about getting laid off, what it's like, trying to figure out like what's next. You know, do I stay in journalism? Do I not stay in journalism? Writing about like my father-in-law passed away very suddenly last year, like writing about that, like opening it up more. So yeah, it's hard. I think anybody who would tell you like, no, it's totally easy. It's great. It's great. Like people, one of the things that makes me insane, and I understand why people do this, but when you get laid off or fired or whatever, a lot of people say to you like, man, this is the best thing that's going to ever have happened to you. And I'm like, man, I don't really want to hear that right now. You know, like I get like, it's like when someone dies, there's not like a lot of great things to say where the person's going to be like, thank you for that. That changed my life. Like it's a bad time. So I get people feel like they have to say something, but it's like, you know, this sucked. It sucked. I broadly speaking, liked what I was doing. I had a profile, it's, you know, I had a salary, blah, 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 blah. So it's like, I had to sort of say like, I need to kind of grieve and mourn that and then move on. And this gets to your, like, how do you feel about CNN question? Like, man, it doesn't behoove me to spend a bunch of time embittered and badmouth CNN. There are a lot of people I love there who have been great to me since I left. Like, what's the point in holding all that stuff, holding those feelings, you know, not much, but it is hard. There's no question. It's a very different thing. But like I get to most days, I get to write about sports and politics and write what I want, which is like really, really, and I have a bunch of freedom, pick my kids up at school. This past weekend, I went to Washington Lee to a soccer camp with my son. Like, you know, I can do all that kind of stuff in a way I didn't before. So I think, but it's humbling. Probably people who knew me then, or maybe even know me now, could say I could use some humbling. But it is humbling. There's no question about that. Anyone who tells you like, man, it's been great. I've been happy every day. I don't buy that.
Before we continue with Two Riders Slinging Yang, a quick word from our sponsor.
Hey, this is Jeff Perlman. I'm here with my son, Emmett, who's really enjoying watching me write my Tupac Shakur biography.
Dad, what does I'm a fucking failure, fraud, piece of shit, douchebag, ho dickwad, and I'll never accomplish anything mean?
What?
I heard you say that yesterday while you were sobbing in a fetal position under your desk.
Yeah, that must have been someone else.
It was you in your office with your girlish whimper.
What's your point?
My point is, you always do this when you have a book to, and there's only one solution. Let's go to royalretros.com and pick out some great throwback USFL gear. Maybe that sweet Chicago Blitz hat you've been eyeing, or a cool Sam Mills Baltimore Stars jersey.
Huh, will that help me finish my book?
No, but you'll stop crying like a little bitch.
It's funny because I have this running thing in my family where a good friend of mine is John Wertheim, who's a host on 60 Minutes.
Yeah. And yep.
My mom has read literally none of my books, but gets very excited when she sees John Wertheim on 60 Minutes.
It's amazing. TV is an amazing medium.
It's crazy. It is.
Yeah. Yep. People feel like they know you. People feel like they know it remains. And like, I get all the stuff about the shrinkage in cable news. I think it's all true. I mean, I think cable news is where print newspapers were 20 years ago. The business model is kind of broken. It still throws off enough money that it can work, but like, it's not the future. But man, it's still super powerful. I mean, I know you know this. Like, when I wrote my book, on a Monday morning at 5 a.m., it had come out on a Tuesday. On the next Monday morning, it was like 6,257th on Amazon.
Yeah.
I did Morning Joe at 6:30 that day. It was number three.
Yep.
Now, it didn't stay at number three. I wish it had. But like, it's still a really, really powerful medium that lots and lots and lots of people watch.
Let me ask you this. I was at the Gaithersburg, Maryland Book Festival last year. And
yes.
I saw you speaking. I was going to introduce myself. I swear to God, I was like, this guy's not going to know who I am. This is like, I'm not even going to do it. Anyway.
Not true. Love your books.
I appreciate that. And I saw you speaking. And it was the Gaithersburg Book Festival in Maryland. I'd never been before. Beautiful. Like.
Wonderful, right?
The best. Grass hills. And like.
It was hot, though.
You're probably speaking in front of 50 people. Like, they're not huge crowds. But
yes,
They're all there to see you. And they're there to hear about your book. And then you sign books and you're drinking a coffee and it's not, and like, it seems like in some level for a guy like yourself, who it was airport recognition and TV and here he is and Chris and blah, blah, and your takes. And there must have been something kind of nice and gentle about that sort of thing, promoting a book and just speaking in front of 40, 30, 50 people.
Yep.
And kicking.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to get too kind of like new agey, but there is like a mental health piece that goes to all this too, is like, you know, as much as you say like, yeah, I've got like a really thick skin, none of this stuff bothers me. Like, people like calling you a moron every single day can get like a little much, you know, like over time. And I learned to kind of deal with it, but I was not in my best, you know, like when I would send out a tweet and then like, you know, people would ratio it and like be dunking on you, which is of course like, you know, the modus operandi of Twitter. I'd be like snappy with my kids and annoyed with my wife because it leaks over. You don't just like draw a line and it's like, okay, because I knew this thing was raging over here that like doesn't really matter in the long run, but it's like a thing. And so one thing that I've realized is a lot of people come out of the woodwork. You know, look, the deal with Substack is it's like, hey, it's pretty simple. I do this thing. I need you to support it. I need you to invest in it. Like, I'm happy to have a free subscriber. I really need you to be a paid subscriber because this is how I make my living. You know what I mean? Like, there's no like money tree that I don't go in the basement and print money, right? Like, this is it. And so like having people who say like, I am going to invest in you because I believe in you and what you are doing is important is like a really, it's like you said, it's I use your word from a while back, quaint in its way, right? Like people are saying, I value what you're writing about and I want to show that support by doing the most personal of things, which is spending my own money on you. And that's been really like affirming in its way, you know, because I think when you have lives like ours, which the truth is like, maybe you disagree with this. One thing that I've always struggled with journalism is this is kind of a lonely profession, particularly book writing, mm-hmm. right? And particularly like what I do now, which is like, this is my house. Like, this is my office at my house. You know what I mean? Like, I don't have an office that I go to. I interact with some people, but you know, not that many. It's a lot of time in your head. And while you kind of like broadly know people are kind of reading it or not reading it, like to have someone reach out and say, I mean, I will tell you, I get the emails when people become paid subscribers to the Substack and it thrills me every time. Like, it's $70. It's not like, you know, all right, I'm going to go buy that Ferrari I've always wanted. But there is something really nice about that because it feels like there's a connection, right? Like it in a way that I think is hard for people like us because it is like a very, you spend a lot of time in your own head. I know you do interviews with, you know, when you're writing a book, you do I did the same thing. You're doing interviews, you're talking to people, but a lot of the time you're like, at least for me, I'm like riddled with self-doubt. Like, is this good? Should I be doing something different? Is this going to sell? you know, like, did I make a bad choice here? Like, and so to have people be like, I vote for you with my checkbook, or that's outdated, out with my Venmo, whatever, is meaningful.
Yeah.
Right. Does that, do you feel that way about the loneliness piece?
I actually was just thinking that, I'm an, like you, I think I'm an extrovert, and people always are like, oh, books, it's a natural fit. In many ways it is. But I also feel like I am sometimes this one thing being wedged into something that I'm not, because it is a ton of time. The reason I write in coffee shops is the illusion of social interaction.
Totally agree. I do that once a week at a minimum. I'll just go and work somewhere. It's not like I'm talking to anybody, but just to be around other people.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm with you 100%. Do you, do you like the hustle of the Substack, or do you ever think like, fucking A, man, I was at Washington Post and CNN and now I'm, you know, tap dancing for $70 subs.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it's like, I'm a big believer in like, things happen to you in life and you don't really get to choose those things, but you get to choose how you react to those things. Cause I like, I, you know, I mean, look, I have a 15-year-old boy and an 11-year-old boy. We're going through with my older one. He's a really good soccer player. I don't think he's like an elite soccer player, but he's a good soccer player. We're going through this tryout process. And what I've tried to explain to him is like, what you can't control is whether this particular coach says, yes, you, I want you. I said, what you can control is your effort, you know, your leadership, your play, you know, put your best foot forward. And you can control how you react to it. And I use my own life. Like, look, man, like I didn't go to CNN in 2017 thinking, all right, in 5 years, they'll lay me off and I'll have to figure out what the hell to do with my life. Right now, of course, you don't think in those terms, but like, that's what happened. And like, I'm not going to just lay in bed for the rest of my life. Like, I'm going to figure out a next thing. So it's like, can I start a podcast? What would it look like? Can I start a Substack? Can I, you know, like, what are the opportunities that avail themselves that I didn't have before? Can I give some speeches to people? You know, like, what can I do that I couldn't do before? So I think it's like accepting that this happened. Now, what are you going to do next? The only real, like, to use the biggest sports cliche of all time that I use on my kids is, you know, it's not how many times you get knocked down, it's how many times you get up. I think of that all the time. You know, it's like, stuff's going to knock you down. That's life. You know, if you stay laying on the ground, you've lost, you failed. If you get up, at least you're, you know, like, look, man, I didn't think, I started the Substack a year ago. I didn't think I had zero expectations for it. You know, we have 3,000 paid subscribers. That's great.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Would I prefer, to your question, would I prefer to have 100,000 paid subscribers? Yes, of course.
Right.
But like, I feel like the line is moving in the right direction from where I started. And I feel like that's all you can do.
Now you, I want to offer some career advice for you, if that's okay. I was,
always.
I always try, whenever I have someone on, I try to find the oldest thing I can find that was written by them or about them. And
love it.
For you, I found February 11th, 1994, the Hartford Courant. Loomis Chafee Windsor. Is it Chaffee or Chafee?
Loomis Chafee School. Absolutely.
Right. Loomis Chafee
Windsor. Tony Prep School.
68. Kingswood Oxford, 62. Chris Cazilla scored 10 of his 21 points off offensive rebounds.
Oh, hell yeah. I was like Rodman back then.
Have you thought, I don't know, taking your talents to the NBA or D League or making a comeback?
Do you know, and we shot the shit over this on his podcast like a year and a half ago. Ryan Russillo and I grew up playing basketball together. Like, I knew him. His cousin was one of my closest friends. So yeah, man, back in those days, Loomis Chafee was not exactly like, I still remember this. You will appreciate this. So we played, it's like an exhibition game.
Wait, wasn't Loomis Chafee the Dunbar of Connecticut? Am I wrong on that?
It was definitely not the Dunbar. It was not even the Sidwell Friends of Connecticut. We played, and this story will affirm that, we played Hartford Public, which is, as you might guess, a big public school.
Okay.
The star player for Hartford Public was a guy named Marcus Camby.
Wow.
Who went on obviously to the NBA and, you know, injuries, but still went to the NBA. I took a shot we played in their gym, and it was one of these big ass public school gyms, a lot of bleachers, right? He blocked my shot. It had to be 35 rows up, and it was still, the trajectory was still going upward when it hit the bleachers. And that's when I thought to myself, you know what, Chris, you're probably not going to make the NBA. six foot three, not super athletic. You're probably not going to make it. So yes, I look, I will say this though. I still play pickup basketball all the time.
So do I.
It is a great community of people. Play down here at a school down here. Like, it's great. For years I played at Gonzaga College High School, which for people who know the DC area has amazing basketball. The Catholic Academy's basketball here is incredible. Paul the Sixth has two Duke commits this year. They just played in the championship against Cooper Flagg's team in the Chipotle Nationals, whatever the hell it was. So I would watch some of these kids and I'd be like, wow, this was not what my high school experience was like. Yeah. The Loomis Chafee School was not that, at least back then.
I'm going to get Marcus Camby on this podcast next week, and he's going to talk to me. He's going to say the moment he realized he could play in the NBA.
Exactly. When I blocked that kid's shot, I thought, you know what? I might have a chance. Yeah, they were number one in the state back then.
You guys were not.
Correct. Yeah. I played for 2 years at Xavier in Middletown, Connecticut, and they were really good. And we had a bunch of guys play D1, and they were ranked, but I never played. I mean, I was like bench sitter of JV.
Right. There's no shame in that.
Yeah.
Let me ask a final question I'm required to ask this on the podcast. I usually have sports writers on here, and I always ask, what is the best confrontation, maddest someone has gotten at you, an athlete, a coach, blah, blah, blah. From your career as a political journalist, what is your best confrontation story?
Yes. I can't remember. I'm trying to remember. I mean, I know exactly what it is. I can't remember the year because I can't remember anything anymore. Elizabeth Edwards, when John Edwards was running for president, so let's see, he was Kerry's running mate in 04. So it was probably 03. There was a debate, you know, one of 100 of these primary debates, and John Edwards was in it. And afterward, you know, like, you're just milling around afterward, like the TV's off, you're just kind of milling around. I was at the Post then. And I was like talking to somebody, one of his people, like who I knew. I think it might have been this woman, Christina Reynolds, who sidebar is a gigantic UNC basketball fan. But I was just like, she was his research director or something. And Elizabeth Edwards came up to me, John Edwards' wife, the late Elizabeth Edwards. And she screamed at me like for 10 minutes straight about how I had not, my coverage of John wasn't fair. And I was biased. And like, it came totally out of the blue. Like, I had no, it wasn't like someone who was like, hey, watch out, Elizabeth Edwards is pissed off at you. And I was like that one stung for a long time. Like, she, like, it was like a straight up like scolding, you know what I mean? Like, it was not like a polite conversation. So I still to this day remember that one.
That's pretty good. Interestingly, yeah. John Edwards, maybe the most easily reachable these days, former major political candidate.
Oh yeah.
Kearney in North Carolina.
He's just kind of hanging out. Rich guy. Just hanging out. Yeah, because he was rich. I remember he came in. I worked for a place called the Cook Political Report. It was my first job out of college. They were a political handicapping service. He came in because he was running against Locke Faircloth, this Republican, in 1998. So he came in 1998 or 2000. Doesn't matter. And I was like, man, that guy is talented. And he really was talented. Now, he used his powers for ill as opposed to good a lot of the time. But man, he is what a natural talent. And he's not that old. You forget, like, he was like 50 in 2004. So he's not, you know, he's probably in his late 60s, early 70s now. Yeah, 70. But yeah, never to be heard from again.
Yeah, crazy. I know. Well, Chris, I appreciate your time a whole lot. I actually love your career transition. I love hearing people who are like, I was over here and shit went down and I just decided to do something different, and they do it and they own it and they sort of embrace it. And I really admire that. So I appreciate you doing this.
Thank you. I'm happy to. The thing that I always tell people is like, man, don't, like, it's okay to like be upset that this happened. It's okay. Like, I think everybody's story is like, man, I'm in it to win it every day. This is perfect. Like, it doesn't have to be perfect. It's like, it's a process. And, you know, you do your best day to day and put your best foot forward and hope it succeeds. But, you know, if it doesn't, you figure something else out to do. But thank you. I'm a big fan. As I said, I recommend the USFL book to almost everyone. I am a huge fan of the Bo Jackson book because I grew up. The reason that I started this sports Substack is because I was having a conversation with my kids about Bo Jackson. And I was like, I showed him some clips and I was like, oh, this book is, you know, you got to read this. And I'm very much looking forward to the Tupac book as a hip hop fan.
And your kid said, what's a book, Dad?
Exactly. They were like, is there an online version of this I can get?
I just watched the 5 second video instead.
Exactly. Is there a YouTube short on this? Exactly.
Yeah. Well, thank you for doing this. I appreciate it.
Of course, man. Thank you.
I want to thank today's guest, Chris Saliza, for joining me on Two Riders Sling Yang. You can follow Chris on Twitter at Chris Saliza and subscribe to his terrific Substack, So What. If you have a chance and enjoy Two Riders Sling Yang, please go to the vehicle of your choice and leave a nice review. I'd be really appreciative. Music is by the great MC White Owl. Thanks again for joining me. Remember, keep riding.